Welcome to Local Foods, Local Places radio show, where we're highlighting voices working to restore the relationship people have historically had with the seed, the soil, the farmer, and the plate. We're hosted by KRZA Community Radio, 88.7 on the FM dial, or streaming live at krza.org, connecting cultures along the Rio Grande. I am your host, Liza Marin. And today I'm super excited to have Miguel Santisteban on the show, coming to us from Taos, New Mexico. And I first met Miguel about 10 years ago when he was invited to the San Luis Valley to talk about traditional agriculture, acequias, and to share his knowledge and love of corn. And I remember that he was able to actually tell the whole history of humanity through the corn plant. And it was just fascinating. And they actually call him Dr. Corn because of his vast knowledge of this plant and its implications in human history. So thank you so much for being on this radio show, Miguel. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. It's great to be here. I always like to talk about farming and corn, my yeast.
Excellent. So tell us a little bit about yourself and where you come from and what your relationship to Taos is.
Or at least the region goes back to time immemorial. You know, of course, me, I grew up and I was born in Albuquerque. I was raised kind of an urban kid, and then later I moved to Dallas for a year, and then I actually graduated high school from Los Alamos. But as time went on, you know, and I started looking at my roots, you know, doing some genealogy, it looks like, you know, some of my bloodlines coming from the Henisado phenomenon, which is Native Americans that were stolen by other natives or by Spanish and then sold into slavery and then granted their freedom after 20 years. And so it looks like I got some roots in Abiquiu and Okeawingue Pueblo in my great-great-grandfather's generation. And it looks like I have some roots in Chicao's Pueblo. I have a great-great-uncle who was on the Taos Pueblo census back in like 18-something, 1800, something like that. So, you know, I would check the box Hispanic or Mexican American, but it looks like I've been in this region, like I say, since time immemorial, and of course I carry a Hispanic or Spanish last name, and those last names, you know, are names of villages in Spain, but it's not clear if we're actually descended from those families or from the Henisado phenomenon, which would have had us Hispanicized and baptized into those family names. On my grandmother's side, on my dad's side, you know, is Rael. And I later learned that Rael is short for Israel. So I've gone a little bit in touch with my Sephardic Jewish roots, you know, analyzing some of the traditions we have that we would consider Northern New Mexican or Hispanic, but are actually Jewish. And so, yeah, I come from a cultural mix, dynamic history. And like you said earlier, you know, it's kind of like the cross-pollination of corn. You know, we've been cross-pollinated over generations, and now carry all the colors in the bloodline.
Beautiful. And talk a little bit about corn and how that came to be something so important to your education and knowledge and learnings.
Well, you know, I wasn't raised farming. You know, I was always raised that I was going to go to college and, you know, get a good career and these kinds of things. You know, I was actually working at Los Alamos National Labs in my high school and college years and preparing myself to be an electrical and computer engineer. But somewhere along the line, they started to freak out on the nuclear industry and just the general devastation, environmental devastation we see on the planet. And so I came to be looking for solutions. So in my college years, that led me to biology and, you know, some type of environmental work. And then I realized that, you know, there needed to be some social, political activism component to addressing these problems. So when I ended up at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, at the time, the land grants and the Native American organization were trying to prevent the Paseo del Norte extension of the highway in Albuquerque that was going to go through the Petroglyph National Monument. And more than a national monument, those petroglyphs are a sacred site to many of the pueblos. And even the land grants understand the spiritual nature of place. So the land grants and the Native Americans united to address that situation. And so I united with them and forged relationships with a lot of the Pueblo people and land grant activists. And, you know, and we worked on that issue. Concurrent to that, the land grant organization that I was affiliated with was the Atrisco Land Rights Council, the Atrisco Land Grant, which is Atlixco, the place near water in the language of Nahuatl, that's actually an Aztec word, which shows our Aztec and Tlaxcalteca history in the settlement of this area. And so they were doing a community garden in addition to all this political work. You know, they had a cultural, social angle to the work, which was to plant a community garden in the South Valley of Albuquerque. So that was actually my first experience with agriculture, putting seeds in the ground, irrigating. And I was guided by the older mentors in the Land Rights Council. And I obtained some blue corn seeds from the father of one of the members of the council. And it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. To see a full barrel, you know, like it was a trash can, but it wasn't used for trash. It was storage as a bin. Well, you know, it was 50 gallons of blue corn shelled in a barrel. And he told me to get my seed in a coffee can. And I remember just looking at that blue corn in disbelief. It was the most beautiful thing to behold. You know, looking into that corn was like looking into a sky covered in beautiful patterns of clouds. It was like looking into outer space and seeing all the stars and nebula. You know, and I came to realize, you know, that corn is our reason for knowing anything. And, you know, the food security that corn, and when I say corn, I mean, of course, I'm talking maize, but any culture on earth can relate to what I'm saying, because corn is a generic term for grain. And every culture on this here planet earth was gifted a grain from the Mother Earth as an umbilical cord, you could say, and to feed us. The Africans got teff and sorghum, among others. You know, the Native Americans got maize and quinoa and amaranth. you know, among others. The Asians got rice and other things, and then the Caucasians got wheat and barley and rye and oats, among other things. So it's just incredible to me that we have a relationship with this. And I realized that the corn, the fact that this man had a living corn seed and food, was actually a connection to the ancient history of keeping corn alive for thousands of years. And that is just profound to me, that you would have a continued line through your ancestry and your shared culture with your people that would keep this organism alive for this long and to sustain us. So I was able to plant that corn, and it was a profound spiritual experience. I could elaborate, or your listenership could find an article I wrote on it in the Green Fire Times, which is online, and I imagine if you do a search, you can read this and many other articles that I've written for the Green Fire Times. But basically, to plant corn is a homecoming. You know, it's a reconnection with the earth and all of her cycles. You start to realize that there's good times to plant and there's times that you don't plant. You know, you realize the different sounds that birds are making as they migrate, or the songs of the crickets when the temperature changes. And so it's a process that brings about an earthly awareness, which is is diametrically opposed to our technological existence, where you can have anything you want anytime, pretty much. And the seasons, you know, don't really matter to people because it's just a change in their fashions or the amount of the increase in electricity or an increase on the thermostat. Rather, growing corn and working with agriculture puts us into the realm of being human, of being a human being, whereas I would argue most humans are humans doing. Humans doing this, doing that. But there's really not a lot of us being. And I think that a great way to be a human being is to reconnect with our nature. I mean, ultimately, we're just elements. We're a mixture of the elements and, you know, earth, water, wind, and fire. And that's what everything alive is. And of course, technology is also that, but it's so manipulated that it's not in its raw and initial form, which, you know, allows some degree of communication, understanding, and incorporation of these elements into your psyche, into your biology, in a way that really can't be understood unless you're a farmer. And that's why, you know, in my line of work, I can relate to all kinds of land-based people. You know, I was surprised I could even relate to the GMO farmers, because even though I'm not particularly into GMOs and the chemicals that are used, I realized that, you know, what held us in common was the relationship to the land, which has me more in common with that type of a person than, say, somebody in a cubicle in a high-rise in a city. You know, we have an understanding, even though we might have different views, we have an understanding of nature, of cycles, seasons, you know, some degree of deference, and having to work with life and death, and very intimately, which I think affords us a greater level of understanding and respect in certain realms.
And you have a family. How's that changed your perspective on your life and your work?
Well, I wonder, you know, it's hard to see the forest for the trees, but I think we're fortunate that I've been doing this work, and now that I'm raising two daughters in this work, you know, I feel like me having daughters, you know, is very fitting, because as the women know, you are the life bringers, the nurturers, and the healers. And so I just feel elated and honored that my girls are learning these ways. You know, my oldest daughter has a middle name, Ais, and my youngest daughter has the middle name, Remedios. So, you know, my daughters are the product of the Garden of Life. And I'm trying to create a situation where they can learn all of this. And it's great. You know, they help me plant. They help me do almost everything, you know, but then at the same time, in generations past, a lot of the young people were forced to do it. You know, you had to hoe weeds all summer or you starved. Luckily, we don't live in that context, so I'm trying to bring my daughters along into the agricultural practice the way I was brought into it, as a passion, as an art form, as cultural expression. And then, yes, of course, it is something that will feed you, but it is also something that feeds other organisms. It is also something that, if done right, can heal the planet, can bring about soils, can bring about soil organisms, can bring about pollinators and birds. And so, yeah, it's hugely satisfying, you know, when, you know, like I say, I don't force my kids to do this kind of work. I don't want them to regard it in that way. But when my kids then ask to help and want to participate, then, you know, that is just infinite reward. And then, you know, and some people, you know, who have maybe seen my work in the past might know that I created a youth in agriculture project called Sembrando Semillas with the New Mexico Aceite Association. In fact, we had some representation in the San Luis area. Back in the day, we had a Sembrando Semillas group that, you know, went beyond the New Mexico Aceite Association. We reached out to our neighbors in Southern Colorado, which a lot of us still regard as occupied Northern New Mexico. And, you know, because we share that cultural history. So, you know, we had a group of Sembrando Semillas teaching the young kids, giving them experience in agriculture. And I helped start that project in 2005. 15 years later, that is still a project of the New Mexico Aceite Association. And now my daughters are participants in that. So my daughters are able to, you know, create stories about their agriculture experience, you know, and what they're learning. And then they present them to the greater Osecyok community in at our annual congreso.
Okay.
And so yeah, it's a great thing to be able to raise my kids this way, and then they feel the pride, you know, amongst the greater Osecyok community. You know, they feel the pride, and then, you know, I look around at the elders of the community who also feel hope. So it's a great thing. You know, I feel kind of like a conductor of a symphony, and, you know, instead of violins and cellos and all of this, you know, I got the crop section going with all the crops. And then, you know, there's all the trees, and then there's the Osecyoks, and then there's the community, and, you know, just all these projects just keeping everything going, you know, little by little, poco a poco. And it turns out to be this awesome symphony. Now, of course, the backdrop of the symphony is all this COVID stuff, which is, you know, a new thing that we're having to contend with. But even still, you know, I'm seeing this bringing out the best in a lot of people, and us making changes and thinking about the future in a very realistic, tangible way.
I see that. Yeah, I see that too. I see neighbors helping neighbors. I see people looking to seeds and farms for their sustenance more than looking for the big box store. And I do see some really positive change. And you were talking about, when I talked to you earlier, about kind of a new initiative that's going on in Taos, or maybe it's been around, but Aire, Taos?
Yes.
Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, you know, well, I've been doing this kind of Osecyok work, agriculture work, youth work, you know, for over 25 years in a variety of contexts. And, you know, and some people are aware of that, you know, who have known me, my close friends and collaborators. And so I have a friend in Santa Fe, and, you know, and she called me up one day and asked me my take on food security in New Mexico. And I knew her from another nonprofit. And so I gave her my deal, you know, what I saw what food security looked like. And I told her all the groups I was aware of doing what. This was in 2007, 2008. And, at the end of the conversation, I asked how she was doing, and after I answered her question, and she told me that she was actually part of a donor group, and that if I started a nonprofit to address food security, that they would fund me for 3 years and maybe more. So then I said, hey, all right, I'm going to start a nonprofit. So I started a nonprofit called IREF. Agriculture Implementation Research and Education. That basically covered everything I thought I might want to do with an agricultural nonprofit in the future. Implement it, research it, and educate about it. Educate myself about it. And so yeah, I started the nonprofit, and we officially launched in 2010. For people who know about our efforts, you know, we partnered with the Osecyok Association and did a lot of radio stuff, the Tevimalap Osecyok radio program was partially orchestrated by IREF, more so than New Mexico Osecyok Association. But, you know, and then I started conducting workshops and doing different types of educational things. I started writing through that nonprofit, doing my research. I was trying to do some PhD research. You know, I had to let my PhD go. Finally, earlier you called me Dr. Korn. maybe I'm a ABD corn, but even that title has expired. But we had started to jump up into one of our cornerstones on this deal was we put Park Field into a garden project, and which still exists. You know, we grew, what was that garden? Was like 60 by 100 feet or something initially, and now it's actually growing bigger. Now it's actually feeding families. You know, and I'm hardly even involved. It's another project that I helped start, and I can just kind of sit on the sidelines and watch it succeed with the great work of other people, and namely Michael Roseberry, who you might have on here later, who runs the Farmhouse Cafe. She's on the board of IVET, and you know, she had this desire to feed our school kids like real food. You know, not all this processed, chemicalized, conventional food that we see in the industrial food system that feeds our institutions. So she went on, you know, I then became the project holder for her project, Growing Community Now, which is online, growingcommunitynow.org, and iredhouse.org. And so she started small, you know, she started feeding like a handful of kids local organic lunches. And over like 5 years, it grew to 650 kids. So before COVID hit, you know, through the Farmhouse Cafe and funds that were gotten in through different foundations and run through IVET, you know, we were feeding these kids locally procured carrots, locally procured vegetables, even beef, you know, and she was able to do all the legwork and do that. So we're moving on that angle, you know. She figured out how to use USDA funds, which is not a lot of money per student, but she was able to figure that out. To be able to provide, you know, nutritious, wholesome meals to the students. Now, part of that was, you know, these kids aren't used to eating that. So they're not used to eating real food. Their food they're used to is laden with salt and sugar. So a lot of what we did was going to the schools and do tastings, you know, offer the kids, you know. So I got to commend the Dow School District for allowing us to do that. There was a lot of relationship building. You know, the Dow School District just passed a resolution that they wanted to do more of this, more local food in the school. So we're making grounds.
That's
We're figuring out how to feed these kids. Now, of course, in the case of COVID, everything's changed. So now the model went more CSA and providing the boxes, you know, in partnership with other organizations. You know, we're committed to that, getting that going now. We're in a limited fashion because of social distancing and these requirements, but we've actually acquired another high tunnel, and that has all kinds of tomatoes and carrots in it. And we've got a small crew of young people, high school mostly, that are learning greenhouse production and going from farm to farm and helping out. So there's the training component, and it's going really good.
Yeah, Miguel, that is so beautiful. I feel nourished by talking to you, just listening to the beautiful work and ideas that you have. And thank you for sharing your beautiful spirit and ideas. And so blessings to you, my friend. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. Let's keep growing community. Let's keep growing hope.
We've been listening to Miguel Santisteban, father, teacher, farmer, and educator. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Stay well.